Welcome to our next talk. Our next two speakers are Stefan Becker and Stefan Kolossa. Stefan Becker holds a master in IT security and is a research assistant and PhD candidate at the Embedded Security Group at the Ruhr University Bochum Horst Götz Institute for IT Security. Stefan Kolossa is also a PhD candidate at Ruhr University since 2017 at the Institute for International Law of Peace and Armed Conflict. Stefan passed his first legal state exam in 2014 and is now, among other roles, a legal advisor to the project Legal Implications in Hardware Reverse Engineering, in cooperation with the Horst Götz Institute. The two will talk about the potential legal implications of a new trade secret which has been introduced in Germany in 2010. So let's give a warm welcome and applause to Stefan Becker and Stefan Kolossa.
Yeah, hello from my side. Thank you very much for being here, actually. I have to say that the time of the day is a bit late for a lawyer, but I think it's just the beginning for everyone here. So indeed, we're Stefan and Stefan, and we want to talk to you about some reflections on the new reverse engineering law that has come into place this year. So it's kind of a brand new law. And the implications for reverse engineering is actually quite huge. Now, as a little disclaimer, we are not giving you an in-depth legal analysis because it's not possible. Every case differs. Every case is a different situation, for example. And in law, all the details count. So that means that we can only give you a broad overview about the developments, about the law in general. And then we will give you a little bit of a guideline, maybe in the end, to be on the safe side. Of course, you might be challenged by some lawyers or some lawsuits, but in the end, I can already say that you shouldn't worry too much in this regard. First, also a little apology for the translators and interpreters, because legal terminology is always really hard to translate. So, where appropriate, I will just use the German and the English version, vice versa. And let's start.
Okay. Hello and welcome from my side as well. So, the question is, why are we actually here? And the answer is, it's my fault. I watched last year's talk, Mehr schlecht als recht, Grauzone Sicherheitsforschung, from some researchers from three different universities who reverse engineered a software which claimed to provide absolute security. And of course, they didn't believe in it. And then after pre-publishing the paper about their research, they got a lot of legal trouble. First of all, they got a declaration to cease and desist. I had to look this up, Unterlassungserklärung in German, from the company producing the software, which, if they would have signed it, would have been the same as an employment ban for them, because it wouldn't allow them to possess tools for decompilation, to install IDA Pro on their computers. So, of course, they didn't sign this declaration, and then the whole thing went in front of the court. This was in total more than 1 year of personal legal trouble for them. In the first instance of the court, there was already a settlement where the company then paid for the legal fees, and the researchers said, the next time we go through the responsible disclosure process. But the question which arose for us as a research group, as an embedded security research group, is what the legal situation of researchers utilizing reverse engineering here in Europe or in Germany actually is. So I want to give you some background about the research history at my group, at the Embedded Security Group at Ruhr University, which now moved to the new Max Planck Institute in Bochum. So we have a long history on reversing embedded devices such as smart cards or electronic locking systems, or even like satellite phones. More recently, we are taking a deep look into hardware, into chips, and we apply reverse engineering on the one hand to understand like the reversing process and to do research about the reversing process itself, and on the other hand, we want to understand better if we can do malicious manipulations to hardware, such as hardware trojans. Thankfully, we also have like an interdisciplinary research graduate school, which is where Stefan comes into place. So there we have people from other disciplines who think about IT security, and even better, we also have lawyers there who understand a lot of security. So we approached Stefan to give us some legal counsel on a research project which I will introduce very briefly. So this is about hardware reverse engineering, and we deal with proprietary chips, yeah, which are protected by a lot of patents. What we want to do is like reverse engineering, so we decapsulate it, we do images of it, and then we want, for example, to extract a net list or to extract some higher level description. Yeah, and we want to know if this process is legal. So could you answer that question for me?
Well, it's a bit difficult, but I can try. So first of all, he came to me with that question, and given that I'm this IP law or competition law, for example, is not exactly my core area, but I was really intrigued by your question, and then I digged into the topic, and now I came up with the answer, and actually I can say clearly and definite, it depends. So let's look at the relevant areas of law. So we don't, unfortunately, have one book or one code of law that we can look into that gives us the definite answers. So we have different areas of law, such as intellectual property law, for example, and competition and trade secret law. Intellectual property law, again, has some different sub-branches, some kind of patent law, for example. We have copyright laws and so forth. So the legal situation is a bit complex. And the potential consequences could be also severe if you get involved with one of those laws, because sometimes you have only civil procedures that we have to face. It means that you have to pay maybe damages or compensation for loss of profit, etc. And this the number of euros is really, or can get really high for that. Thank God we have no punitive damages, unlike in the US, for example. But also, more importantly, sometimes you have criminal procedures or criminal charges that you might be threatened with if you infringe, for example, with semiconductor laws. And that's why the question of is it legal or not is not just a simple question of yeah, probably, or most likely, but is actually a serious one. So let's look at the first act of law. This is the Semiconductor Protection Act. And yes, that exists, because we have a law in Germany for everything, also for semiconductors. And the main idea is actually, it's parallel more or less to the patent law. The Semiconductor Act wants to protect three-dimensional structures of microelectronic semiconductor products. And it is not my invention, actually, to phrase it like that, but it is a legal definition of a topography that I took from the law. So if you look into the law yourself, it's not really long, so you can just read it at night, for example, as a good night lecture. And you might always, you will always find the word topography, and it is, unfortunately, this kind of definition. Here the idea is that the topography is protected, but only the topography as such. So only this three-dimensional structure of microelectronic semiconductor products. That also means that information that is stored on that, like firmware or any kind of other information, is not protected by this act, so it's not protected actually by the registration. And the basic rule is simple, you must not reproduce one of the topographies. So if you do that, if you reverse engineer it, for example, and put it together again and try to how it works, is actually prohibited, like per se, under the basic rule.
Well, that's pretty unfortunate, because that's exactly what we want to do.
Well, we have a fortunate clause that gives you an exception, actually. So, the exception is found, again, this is a legal terminology, section 6, paragraph 2, number 2. And there it says that reproductions of the topography for the purposes of analysis or education are not protected. So that means, simply, as a kind of background, that, of course, you want to protect the intellectual property, but at the same time, you have the freedom of research protected under our constitution, for example. And that means that there must become kind of exception for researchers, for universities, for institutes that serve the aim of knowledge, actually acquiring of knowledge, or making the product even better, or closing security gaps, or something like that. So for researchers, we have this exception clause. And actually, under the Semiconductor Protection Act, at least you're fine for that.
Okay, does that make sense? Arguing with the Constitution is always a good way.
It is, actually. It is. Now, let's go to the second law that could come into play. Let's say you don't have the Semiconductor Act in place. You might be involved with a Patent Act. With a patent-protected product, which is not sometimes even protected by one single patent, but by several patents at the same time. And here again, the idea of the law is simple. You want to protect the technical innovative invention, the intellectual property. And again here, the basic rule is simple. You must not unauthorizedly use the product that is protected by the patent. So if you have an authorization, it is fine. If you don't have a legal, per se, definite authorization to use it, you must not do so. Quite simple. But again, here, this is actually parallel to the Semiconductor Act. We don't have an absolute protection, but the patent is not protected against actions for experimental purposes. Now, here again, the wording differs, and for lawyers, the wording is always really important. But again, the background of that is that you want to protect actually research. You want to protect the ones that don't want to use the knowledge that they gained for maybe bring up a competitor's product, or to use it per se like against the other company, but actually who just want to make maybe the product safer, or want to debug it, or maybe find any kind of malware on it. So for that you have an exception clause. And also in the jurisprudence, this term of experimental purpose is usually widely interpreted. So it is for everything that has to do with gaining new knowledge on a technical uncertainty. So whenever maybe, because as a patent, you have to describe when you register your patent how your product works in quite details. But if, for example, there is maybe a legal uncertainty somewhere, you can just dig into that problem and do research on that, and for that also maybe infringe the patent. So that is fine. So also under the Patent Act, you're fine. A bit different was, at least, the situation under trade secret law, and that is the main law that has changed. Also, that's why we do this talk, actually. First of all, the idea of trade secrets comes with the competition law, that anything that is protected in a kind of a, like de facto or de jure, for example, and that can be used against the competitor in unfair use, for example, there is protection to not to use the secret know-how. Now, what is prohibited is actually the accretion or the acquisition of a secret know-how in order to use it against a competitor, and most likely in an unfair way. That's why also the former Unfair Competition Act comprised these rules. And especially in section 17, paragraph 2, it was said that it's generally prohibited to use any kind of trade secrets.
So why am I affected on this? I think I'm not a competitor of the hardware vendors and the hardware manufacturers.
That is absolutely true. But at the same time, what the law wants to make sure is that the law, that the trade secret is actually protected in a most absolute way. So especially how right now, not maybe not so much with regard to the old law, but with the new law, any kind of person could come, could reveal actually this kind of trade secret, and any kind of person, any kind of natural person could be the infringer, in theory at least. And especially this is, this area of law has been awarded a lot of attention lately, because sometimes you have now some kind of information, some kind of maybe even firmware or something like that, that is not protected by the patent, or that is not protected by the Semiconductor Act or something like that. So the IP law falls sometimes short, and then what can come into play is simply trade secrets. Also, with regard to the distinction, of course, where normally under the patent law, for example, you need to disclose all the information that you have, and the trade secret actually gives you the opportunity to just keep it a secret and not to disclose anything regarding that kind of information. So it's also a different mechanism of protection. And regarding that, we had an EU regulation adopted in 2016 already. And it's quite detailed, actually, a quite detailed regulation under the EU. And the time limit, because it's a regulation, so it needs to be adopted and to transfer it into national domestic law by the member states. That time limit for adoption and for transferring that regulation was June 2018. And Germany decided not to play with the rules and not to stick with the deadline, but it finally adopted the domestic law in April 2019, a bit later. But better later than never, because now we have quite harmonized rules on the trade secrets. And that is important because you used to have a quite diverse situation in France and UK and Italy and Germany. So sometimes some certain things are protected in one state but not in the other. So especially when you work in an EU environment and not just locally in Germany, that is really handy. So the Trade Secret Act, usually it was a bit of a difficulty to define actually what is a trade secret, and that has been an issue for decades, I would say. Now it is defined as information that is not generally known among or readily accessible to persons within the circles that normally deal with the kind of information in question. Also legal terminology, sorry for that. Then the information must be subject to reasonable steps to keep it a secret, and there must be a legitimate interest to keep it a secret. Usually that interest is simply the secrecy of being a commercial value, for example. Now, the problem here is already what is the trade secret for reverse engineers, because especially we have this requirement of information that's subject to reasonable steps to keep it a secret. But again, reasonable is an undefinite terminology, undefinite word. So here we need some clarification. And actually, if we look back into the history already under the old law, it was not really, it had some kind of comparable approach to it. And we can look back, for example, to 1935, to the Reichsgericht, where there was a shoe press case involved, or Stiefeleisenpresse in German. And the idea was that a competitor of that producer produced that shoe press, actually wanted to acquire the shoe press for a cheaper price, but the competitor declined, and then they just tried to reverse engineer that shoe press and to reverse engineer the other hardware, the mechanism of how that worked. And then, so finally, the case ended up in front of the court, and the court decided several issues. And first of all, it's kind of tried to define what is a trade secret and what is actually reasonable steps to keep that information a secret. But also it didn't end up really lucky because, again, it decided that it depends on the reasonable amount of time that you need to do the reverse engineering process or the reasonable effort that you put into the reverse engineering. So in the end, we don't really clear with what is actually reasonable or not. But at least for our case, when you deal with hardware, with chips, for example, computer chips, to hardware reverse it, it's, I think, most likely very time-consuming and costly. So that can be regarded as a trade secret per se for that purpose. So in general, for reverse engineers, it always depends on the simplicity or easiness of the reversing act. But in the end, at least for the hardware reversing on chips, that will certainly be met, I think. Now we have the prohibition, maybe a bit more broadly construed than before. So a trade secret must not be acquired through unauthorized access to relevant documents subject to the control of the trade secret owner. Some kind of spying is, for example, prohibited, and through any other immoral conduct. And actually, immoral conduct sounds a bit weird in that perspective sometimes, but also in this shoe press case, the court had to decide whether this reverse engineering was in the end immoral or not, and it decided that yes, it was. So here, again, actually, we had the question of, is reverse engineering per se an immoral conduct or not? But the good aspect is right now that we have a new rule that points out that actually reverse engineering, at least under the Trade Secret Act, is legal or is lawful. Because right now we have a specific rule that says the acquisition of trade secrets is lawful by the means of observation, study, disassembly, or testing, which means reverse engineering. And the product, that's another requirement, the product has to be made available to the public. Actually, that's the most important alternative here of that phrase. So whenever actually the good or the product is on the market publicly available, then it is available to the public, so everybody can buy it, and then you can do research on reverse engineering, for example. This might be a bit different when, for example, certain companies are being made the offer, for example, to pre-test certain kind of products. That might be a bit different there, but at least as soon as it's publicly on the market, purchasable for everyone or by everyone, then it is subject to Section 3. So that's actually the very good news. So in the end, I would say that we have, first of all, a good idea right now that intellectual property law protects actually reverse engineering, so it is not against it. We have competition and trade secret law that at least right now specifically allows for it, and that also allows for another debate that actually exists amongst lawyers, because certainly this is true for hardware reverse engineering. If you do software reverse engineering, it might be a bit different because you might you're subject to the Copyright Act, for example. So there are a bit different rules sometimes. Also, the main idea that reverse engineering is not prohibited per se, that is also true. But here, also when it comes to hardware plus firmware, then you might end up sometimes with software and with Copyright Act. It might be a bit difficult, but again, also the main idea is that reverse engineering is true, or is lawful. And wherever there is an uncertainty right now, people or the lawyers say that whenever there's uncertainty in the intellectual property law side with regard to reverse engineering, then it must be also interpreted as legal because we have now the specific clause in the new trade secret law. So actually that law is quite important for reverse engineering right now and is also a good actually a highlight, I would say, in the future debates of IP law and related fields. So in general, the outlook is quite good, I would say. So in the end, as a guideline for researchers, it's actually quite simple because, first of all, keep calm and do your research. So you don't be afraid of any lawyers that will come up. I mean, certainly some lawyers will try. And maybe they will succeed in some cases, but usually overall, again, they shouldn't. Then what the law does not provide for, actually, but we should do is follow the responsible disclosure process. In general, with regard to the Trade Secret Act, for example, it does not really differentiate between the reverse engineering act per se, so the information that you gain out of the act, and what you do afterwards with that information. So to say, in terms of research, you want to publish it in a journal, for example. So is that allowed or not? Well, it's not clearly set so in the code, But because we don't have this kind of distinction in the code, it's most likely also legal. Because we have now this general general allowance in the know-how law, so to say. So in general, it's most likely also legal if you just publish it in a journal, but nevertheless, to be on the very safe side, you should follow a responsible disclosure process, and also you have made some good experiences with that so far, right?
Yeah, recently in our group, we made some good experiences with responsible disclosure. So a colleague of mine found like a hardware vulnerability where like millions of devices are affected, which will be in the market probably for at least 10 or 20 more years. And then like those big companies, those hardware manufacturers, they have mechanisms in place to disclose responsibly. And the experience my colleague made was that he got like really, like he got an answer within just 2 days from the company. And they asked for a technical write-up. Then they needed a little more time to confirm this technical write-up, actually. And afterwards, on the one hand, they sent the vulnerability to their customers under NDA. Yeah, they didn't disclose how it actually works, but they told the customers, okay, there is a vulnerability in our product. And on the other hand, right now we are coordinating like the publication of the paper and the publication of the vulnerability together with the company. So like some of those like bigger companies have mechanisms in place. I don't know how it is for, you know, like small German Mittelstand. They might never answer to your responsible disclosure, but nonetheless, then you should do it and you should give them some time at least before you publish.
And just in case maybe you end up in an emergency situation that you maybe get a nice letter in your mailbox and it's from an opposing attorney that tries to sue you, for example, then also keep calm and just ask a lawyer. Because first of all, if maybe you're threatened by a horrendous sum that you should pay or something like that, don't be afraid of that, first of all, because if you go to a lawyer and just ask him for a first time of advice, this per se, so the costs of for the lawyer per se, they are not super high. Actually, they're also covered by law, so it's it must not be higher than 190 euros plus tax. So that is also a good side, and then in the end also, because you have quite a good law on your side, if you do hardware reverse engineering, then if you win the case, for example, then also the opponent, the losing side, actually pays all the fees for the lawsuit. So that's also a good part. Of course, it doesn't solve all the problems, because especially certain areas also are not very clear in terms of jurisprudence. They also have to discover this law. But at the same time also, and I think that's also a point that we could take from the last year's talk, was that the judge, even though they ended up with an agreement, but the judge actually mentioned that the case against our colleagues was quite weak. So in the end, I think they wouldn't have won the case. I think the opponent attorneys wouldn't have won the case, but it would have looked really good for the researchers. So, as a summary, it's actually a good point that security research overall is taken into broad consideration by lawmakers. That also holds true for other areas. We have a different regulation that specifically deals in the recital with the permission the patent or the copyright law infringement, for example, if you do research on encryption or something, or decryption. So that also, if it's regard to cybersecurity, this kind of aspects, the research on that is usually largely protected by now. It has several instances where that was mentioned. So overall, it shouldn't look so bad. Of course, that's no guarantee, like in front of the court, so in the law, and on the high sea, you're in God's hands, so you never know, of course, but if you follow the guidelines, actually, and if you just keep calm, there shouldn't be so much of a problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your legal advice.
Yes, thank you, Stefan and Stefan. And we actually have a few minutes for your questions. Yeah, maybe there are some, I suppose. If you have one question, please just use the microphones here in the 1, 2, 3. And we start with question from microphone 2, please.
Hi, and thanks for your talk. I wanted to know, what if I develop tools for reverse engineering and I want to sell them or release them? Am I some way liable or should I be scared?
Selling it to like in general on the markets, not just to other maybe researchers,
yeah, on
just on the market. No, in general, no, because if in the end, always the one who does the research or the reverse engineering actually is supposed to display or declare that their research or their act, what they're doing, is for the purpose of research. So whenever they use maybe your tool that you used for maybe your toilet, solid grounds for a different purpose, then it's up to them actually that they maybe infringe patent law, whatever. The reverse engineering product per se should not be illegal, actually. No.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mic number 3, please.
Hello. Yes, thank you for your talk as well. I was wondering if vendor specifically states in their terms of services that disassembling, reverse engineering, and decompiling of their product is not allowed. Is that something that this talk that you just gave is superseding? Like, is how strong are the terms of service in a legal way?
Excellent question. In general, always what you want to do, of course, if let's say the law prohibits a certain act, then you want to, by an individual contract, just prohibit that behavior. And that happens quite frequently, especially in the general terms of agreements. Now, you mentioned decompilation. So if it's regarding software, it might be a problem if you really decompile software, because that's actually not reverse engineering that is allowed. Like, that's what I said. Software is a bit different sometimes. If you have a clause that says you must not reverse engineer, basically, or you must not study, or like the law, for example, phrased it, this clause is most likely not will not uphold in court, because if it's a general term of agreement, the court can decide on the lawfulness on this kind of general term. So not if it's an individually discussed contract, but if it's like this general terms of agreement, and then the court must also decide whether some kind of clause is against a basic legal idea. And right now, with regard to the trade secret law, it says really clearly that reverse engineering must be allowed. So when then it infringes with that really clearly stipulated rule, actually, then also that general term of agreement would not hold up in court and such. But again, with regard to software, there's sometimes some kind of exceptions. So with especially regard to decompilation, so that might be a bit different, but that's the general thing.
All right, thanks. We go to mic number 2, please.
Yeah, hello. So you talked mostly about hardware reverse engineering, but often what you do when you hardware reverse engineer something is you extract some data from inside the chips, and then you end up with a sequence of bits, and those bits usually encode a computer program. So the rest of the reverse engineering then is deals with software. So you didn't talk about the Computer Programs Directive. I suppose that's relevant here. As far as I remember, that one has some, it allows you to do some things, but it's very strict about publishing things. So, for instance, publishing the result, the information that you gain through decompilation in the cases where you're allowed to decompile. So I'm wondering if you're, the moment you start analyzing the bit stream that you've extracted, if you're then in software land already, or if you can use the hardware.
Also excellent question, and we were also discussing that a bit beforehand. Yeah, if you end up with software, that could be protected by the Copyright Act, so Urheberrechtsgesetz. And there you have one rule also that this kind of basic reverse engineering is allowed, but you also have another rule that says you must not decompile. So in the sense, if you just translate your or produce some kind of source code in totum or completely, that would be regarded as decompilation. And that is only legal if you want to enhance interoperability with different systems. If you don't do that, actually, then it's a bit problematic and most likely prohibited. But on the other hand, if you do maybe some kind of black box testing, so not decompile the whole code, but maybe use only more specific areas or black box testing, then also this kind of reverse engineering on that part is not regarded as decompilation. So then you're also out of that rule. And then also, again, it holds true that reverse engineering is legal. So it depends on the exact set of circumstances, actually.
Yes, I have one question to our signal angel. Do we have any questions from the internet? Okay, well, so then we go over to mic one, please.
In your answer to the first question, you said that if someone used a tool that was originally meant for some other benign purpose and used it to reverse engineer something, the toolmaker would be not liable. So what if the toolmaker specifically said, okay, this tool can be used to reverse engineer XYZ. I never done this, but I could think I think it might work. Would they still not be liable?
Well, you must, in the end, the one who you mean, the one who does in the end the reverse engineering with that.
No, the person who makes the tool, not the person who reverse engineers.
Well, if that tool is also potentially a perfect legally tool to use reverse engineering, and then the other person just misuses it or abuses it, that is actually totally fine at that point.
Even if you say you can break the law with that.
Well, you shouldn't do so. I would never say that aloud, of course. I mean, don't get yourself into even the discussion of the trouble. So just avoid any kind of that and only state and stipulate that you're doing it for research on hardware reverse engineering or reverse engineering in general.
Thank you.
Be on the safe side.
Yes, thank you. And we have one last question, I assume, from mic number two.
Yeah, so I will use this for two questions. So as a researcher, I'm generally allowed to re-engineer products, which is good news. So first, how does anything changes if I make this documentation publicly available? So I re-engineered a piece of hardware that only falls under patent law, and now I publish these design files for free, under free license on the internet. Is that legal?
And also, here's a little discussion. Because it is clearly legal if that information is part of intellectual property law. There is one discussion that says this kind of information is also some kind of know-how protection, so also in the direction of a trade secret, more or less. If you interpret it, and that's not completely clear yet, but most likely, it is actually also intellectual property and know-how protection. So if you maybe have this hardware infringing on the patent rights, and then you publish it in a journal or something like that, that most likely is also legal in that regard, yeah. But there is this internal discussion, actually, amongst the lawyers, whether it's know-how or whether it's simply intellectual property, actually.
Well, I could publish it on GitHub and then link in my paper to that. Is it still legal?
Well, in general, I would say yes, without liability here, but yeah.
Okay. And second, how do I qualify as a researcher? I mean, can I do the research just by myself and claim I am a researcher and just doing it for the matter of science, whatever I clarify as science?
Yeah, so throughout the different areas of law, you have really broad terminology in that regard. So, of course, you're on the perfectly safe side if you work with an institution, like a university or an institute, something like that. If you do it completely privately, it would Well, there's also another exception clause that if you do that simply for private purposes, but that would include that you don't publish anything. If you just do it for the research, at least you must state what kind of expectations you have to acquire new knowledge or maybe to solve a kind of a mechanical problem or something like that. So you cannot just broadly state that I'm doing research, whatever that is, but I'm doing research. But you need then at least to specify what is your expectation, your findings, what you want to do actually, what you want to achieve with it. And then, but it could be also, it can be regarded as research as such then, yeah.
Cool, thanks.
And that wraps it up. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. And let's all say thank you again to Steffen Becker and Stefan Kolossa for their talk. And let's give them a warm round of applause.